of you that are here, and if there are folks on the phone that I can't see, there are a few people that I can see who are participating in the Zoom meeting, Cassandra, John, and Remy, and the rest, and we'll do a roll call here in just a minute. But thank you, everyone, for being part of this first back Zoom meeting, or probably any kind of an electronic gathering, I think. Is that right? To those of you who've been at this for a long time?
This is the first time.
Yeah, it's different, but we're still together. It's just feels a little different, but at least we're together. This evening, it just seems right to begin the meeting by acknowledging that there have been some really hard things going on in our country right now. And Dr. Melnick has offered to provide some comments to kind of ground us as we struggle with some of the things we've been seeing on TV and hearing about going across the country that are really born out of what we haven't overcome yet, which is systemic racism. So, Dr. Melnick, if you would, please.
Thanks, Marla. So, Ashley issued a statement to all of the public health staff, and I'm going to basically share my thoughts that I had in the statement with our team. But basically, I wanted to acknowledge her that, you know, this recent unconscionable, senseless, violent death of a black man, George Floyd, at the hands and knees of several police officers, unfortunately reminds us that systemic racism and implicit bias continue to threaten the lives and health of individuals and communities of color. And this also reminds us that in addition to homicide, systemic racism, implicit bias cause, and you know, we've been working on these issues in fact, but cause short and long-term effects by reducing access to things like education, employment, safe and affordable housing, and healthy food. And as a result, communities of color experience a completely preventable health disparities, you know, things like poor birth outcomes, a greater burden of chronic disease, and a shortened lifespan. And as we're continuing to witness an increased likelihood of morbidity and mortality from COVID-19, I mean, COVID-19 is a biologic phenomenon. It's a virus, but it has affected Latinx and African American populations and other communities of color out of proportion to their demographics nationally, statewide, and in Clark County. I was looking at the data for Clark County, and the Latinx population's experience with COVID-19 was out of proportion to the white population, but after the white non-Hispanic population, but after the Firestone outbreak made those disparities even greater. And so we're continuing to experience that. I also pointed out, and you know, it's the same message for FAC, that our mission, both in the Public Health Advisory Council and FAC, is to protect and improve the health of our communities. And to do so, we have to acknowledge that racism is a public health threat that we can't ignore, and we must continue to fight justice and racism in solidarity with communities of color. You know, what important part of what we need to do. And I'm hoping, you know, as we're going through COVID-19 and our meetings, future meetings and back, you know, other things that we face, I'm hoping that we can continue, or we can have some discussions about how we can recognize, acknowledge, and address our own implicit biases while moving Clark County Public Health and our community forward in addressing some of these systemic factors, including racism, that lead to inequities and adverse health outcomes for communities of color in Clark County and elsewhere. So, I mean, I know a lot of us are experiencing a wide range of emotions on this. This is unbelievable, but it is unfortunately believable because it keeps on happening, and it's senseless. I'm hoping that that we can take, well, I don't want to say take advantage, but basically use this moment to move forward and support each other in addressing racism and working, like I said, in solidarity with our communities of color. So that's kind of a message I gave to the staff, and I wanted to share that with the as well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That was very well stated, and it's just such an important reminder for all of us right now. And I do believe that it is an opportunity, and I hope that we are able to bring some sustainable good out of all of this heartbreak. So thank you for that. So the next thing that we're going to do is a roll call. And how we'll be doing this, because we can't see everybody that's on, that's involved in this meeting. And so what I'm going to do is read off the names of the SAC members. And when I call your name, if you could just, I can see you if you're on Zoom, but not everybody can see all of us. So if you could please just say whether you're on the phone or on Zoom, and then what is your role on the SAC committee? So here we go. Did everybody hear that okay? Any nodded hands here? Very good. All right. So Sandra Brown.
I'm here via Zoom, and I represent the community.
Thank you. Joan Kaley.
You're muted, Joan.
You're
still muted. Oh, there you go.
Here she comes. Hi, Joan. Can you hear us? Well, she's there. She took herself off mute, so.
Oh, actually, I took her off mute.
Oh, okay.
She may be doubly muted now if she's got her own system muted.
She might, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, Joan, we see your name, so hopefully you're able to hear us. Paul Childers.
He's muted also.
Yeah, okay. But I see his name there. Mark Collier.
Yes, I'm here on Zoom.
Thank you.
And I represent installers and maintenance people and designers.
Thank you.
Hey, Marla, I'm here.
Okay, it's the phone issue. All right, thank you.
Marla, I'm here.
That was Joan.
Yeah, I'm here.
Is that Joan?
Yeah, I'm here as the representative.
Okay, thanks, Joan. Let's see, Adrian, I see your name on the screen.
Hi, guys. I'm still at work, so I unvideoed myself. Unless you want to see me running around with a bunch of dogs.
Okay.
I want to see the dogs.
I would like that.
You guys want to see what's happening?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. We do want to see the dogs.
No, there was just a chicken here.
Oh, chicken's
cool. This is my life here. These are my staff members. And
hi, everybody.
So I'm here in present, and I represent veterinarians practicing in Clark County.
Great. Thanks for being with us, Adrian. And
you're welcome.
Sharing your world with us. Dave Fuller.
I'm here on Zoom representing Clark Emergency Management.
Thank you. And then Charbonneau.
I am here representing the public education world.
Thank you. Haiti.
I'm here on Zoom representing the youth of Clark County.
Thank you, Katie. Lawrence Neville.
Hey, Marla. I'm online. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well. Thank you. I see your name there now. Thank you. John Brooks, I see you.
I'm here, Marla, on Zoom, representing the Clark County Law Enforcement.
Thank you. Stephanie.
I'm here. I represent a nurse practicing in Clark County.
Excellent. And you're on the phone, it looks like. Thank you. Let's see, John Ross. Not seeing John. Marla Sanger, consumer of public health on Zoom. And next is Cassandra. And I did see...
Hi, this is Cassandra Sellers-Dreck. I'm a representative of Cowlitz Indian Tribe, tribal member. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And Aru is going to be a little bit late. And that is the membership. So thank you, everyone. It sounds like we do have a quorum, so that's terrific to be able to conduct business. Bear with me as I'm looking up and down because I've got some great notes that the staff helped help me with and put together for me. That's making it so that I don't forget anything. So I'm asking now if there are any guests who have called in to participate in this meeting just to listen, and or if there are any guests that are here to provide public comment. If so, if you speak your name now and say whether you're on Zoom. If you are, I'm not seeing you, but or if you've called in. So I'm not hearing anyone respond at this time. So we possibly might have Quentin Harold from CMAR. So if you're here, Quentin, welcome. So I think we'll move on then. Start our formal business by approving the meeting notes. And those were sent out prior to the meeting. So hopefully everyone's had a chance to look at those. And assuming that we have, then I am going to ask someone to state your name and make a motion that we approve the minutes of the prior meeting. And then if someone would state their name and second the motion, then I'll ask for a vote and we'll complete that portion of our business.
Remy Houston, I move to approve.
Joan Cayley, I approve to second.
Thank you. Thank you both. So there's been someone has moved to approve and there's been a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Is anyone opposed? Hearing no opposition, we will approve the minutes of the last meeting. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to go through the agenda topics really quickly. I think you all got that ahead of time, but just so you know what's coming up next, we will have a time for public comment, but it doesn't sound like anyone is to provide that. So if anybody is, tell us now. Hearing no one, we'll move on with beyond that. Then we're going to have a department update. Jeff will be providing us with the budget, and we'll hear some of the finer points of what's going on in the county and at the state. COVID-19 funding and then the 2021 budget. The next thing will be some presentations that Alan and Roxanne are going to do for us. They will be projecting slides on the screen. There's also a hard copy that was sent out electronically for those who may not be able to see the screen. So please feel free to come along with us in those presentations because we would really like for the members of the FAC committee to ask questions, make comment, really participate in the portion of the meeting where we're going to have the presentations. And then we're going to have Alan tell us about the Washington phased reopening and what the requirements are and how we might expect that to unfold. And then the phase two waiver process and the status of that. And then the final thing will be the executive committee. We'll mention when the next meeting is, and that's what we have on the agenda for tonight. So let's get started. So the first thing we have, we'll pass the public comment, and we're getting ready for the first department update. So I think this is going to be Jeff.
Can everybody see the slides okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Hello, everybody. I should have probably put the very last bullet on this page at the very top. So the county expected, due to the coronavirus impact on the economy, the the county expected a 35% decline in sales tax revenue for March. They also expected a 50% decline in sales tax revenue for April, May, and June. The 35% expectation for March ended up only being 16%. So the county is sort of awaiting April and May data before taking any serious action. But back up to the top, that expectation caused the county to ask departments to submit one-time 2%, 3%, and 5% reduction packages for the current year. The reduction is only of the general fund support received. For public health, it's roughly 13.5% of our total budget, or just over $1.8 million. We also have the solid waste fund, but that is an enterprise fund and does not receive any general fund support whatsoever. Our proposal was to actually utilize department fund balance to offset any 2020 budget directives around reducing our general fund support. You know, in the middle of the coronavirus response, we really didn't have the necessary time to strategize and vision what a reduction would look like at those levels. It appears that our proposal has been accepted by the county manager and budget office and the finance team. The medical examiner's office is almost completely funded with general fund support. It's a general fund department. It's also a mandated service in Washington State. Our recommendation was actually not to reduce. We did not provide any recommendations for the 2, 3, and 5% reductions. Their budget actually needs more support, not less. With the supply chain interruption, their supply costs are increasing. Since they've been with public health, we've actually identified some process changes we'd like to put in place that will also cost money. So that's the county budget slide for 2020. If there are any questions on this slide, I can take them now. Okay, who want to advance to the next slide? So, COVID-19 funding. I honestly thought after measles last year, I was looking forward to a break and not having to deal with any more of this stuff. So COVID-19, public health initially, we were the first department in the county to receive any grant funding. We received $1.05 million. It's almost equal share of federal and state revenue. We received it from Department of Commerce. I'm sorry, Department of Health made the award. We also have numerous funding sources, existing federal grants. Actually, the sub-bullet under that 1.05 is not accurate. That grant actually runs through December of this year. That $1.05 million does. anyway, where I was going, we've got several federal grants that we've worked with the state and the feds. They're allowing us to bill COVID response costs against those funding sources. Those are our existing grants that we had prior to COVID. Also, very recently, the state of Washington, they have released expanded state foundational public health services, or FPHS, revenue. It was intended to fund enhanced Hep C services. Our share is $116,000 per year. They're allowing us to spend that also on COVID response. The first year revenue actually was July 1st, 2019 through June 30th of 2020, so it ends in 21 days. And we were just notified about this pretty recently. So most of that first year's revenue will go to offset COVID costs. Clark County's share of the CARES Act funding, this is the large bucket of money. Clark County is receiving $26.8 million roughly. And that's where that sub-bullet from above should go. That allocation from the feds was intended to expire December 31st of this year. However, the state of Washington has decided that locals will have until October 31st to spend it, keeping 2 months, the back 2 months for state sources. We haven't really gotten a clear indication on why that decision was made, but that's the decision that we're dealt with. with so many funding sources, my finance staff, we're really doing a diligent job tracking all of our costs and making sure that we're assigning each individual expense to a specific funding source, just to avoid double dipping, you know, finding ourselves in hot water with auditors down the road. Any questions on the coronavirus funding or expenditures? I do see in my note on the Federal CARES Act money, the $26.8 million, our application against those funds is now $8.49 million, just for public health alone. $5.26 million of that is the contract with the Public Health Institute to do contact monitoring. I'm sure Alan will be talking more about that. I want to go to the next slide. Our department budget for 2021, we are right now in the process of developing our 2021 operating budget. Basically what we do is we have managers allocate their FTE and then make requests for their supplies and services, travel, etc. We began, once that was done, we plugged in the revenue. We began with a $1.3 million deficit. We have some longer-term federal COVID-19 grant revenue that's looking like to be around $250,000 per year. That was added. The proposed adjustment to our environmental public health fee schedule, right now the impact to our budget, if approved by the council, would be an additional $484,892 in revenue. And then the enhanced foundational public health services funding that I spoke about earlier, that's actually an ongoing source, and that's another $116,000 per year. Those of you who do math on the fly can see that does not cover the entire $1.3 million deficit. We'll be working with the county manager and the county council on strategies to actually address whatever deficit remains. The fee schedule adjustment has not been approved by the council. We expect to have one-on-ones, one-on-twos with counselors in the next couple weeks. It'll follow the same process as in past years. We'll have one-on-ones, one-on-twos with the council. We will then have a work session with the council, and then we would bring forward a resolution later this year to adopt whatever changes to that schedule that they decide. One more item I had written down. I just saw it today, and I saw this earlier. I should have put it down, but it reminded me. Right now, the state of Washington is expecting a $3.8 billion shortfall in the current biennium, which ends next June 30th. That's what their expectation is right now. And we have the $1.3 million deficit for our department. That does not include any cuts to our local or state funding.
Jeff, I had a question. This is Roxanne.
Yeah.
Back on the prior slide, I didn't get my mute off soon enough.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that CARES funding and that part of it, that almost $8.5 million that's allocated to public health? Could you talk about the additional funding and where that's going?
There's actually 12 project positions included in that staff report. Those are program managers and program coordinators. Those are going to be managing segments of our incident management team, or when the incident management team demobilizes, they'll shift to the communicable disease unit and provide the ongoing case investigation support, wraparound services, deliver purchasing of groceries, prescriptions, etc. for people in isolation and quarantine. We also are paying for security services at the hotel facility that is providing lodging for the unhoused population that is in isolation and quarantine. We have quite a bit of funding set aside for medical transportation, as well as, again, those wraparound services themselves. It's the, again, the groceries, the prescriptions, etc. We're paying, in some cases, we're paying rent, providing rent assistance, mortgage assistance for those that are in isolation and quarantine and not able to work because of the situation they find themselves in. And then it's also paying for just our existing incident management team structure, where our other funding sources, once those are actually exhausted.
Something to this a little bit, Roxanne, is that okay? So, so the CARES Act funding has to be spent on COVID-19 related activities. And I was just on a call with our state colleagues, Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials, and I was just kind of blown away because some of the jurisdictions. So basically, out of this CARES Act funding, $60 per capita went to both counties and cities. And so the cities got funding as well based on their population. And I was just on a call with my WASALPO, Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials colleagues, and I learned that some jurisdictions are not providing any funding to their public health departments. They're using all the funding, or most of it, if not all of it, to support local businesses affected by COVID-19. And and I'll talk about this a little bit more, but I was kind of blown away because the whole idea of this physical distancing was to flatten the curve and give us enough time to build a robust public health response, which is what we're talking about with the CARES Act funding. And some jurisdictions are moving forward in the phases without doing so. So I'll talk about that a little bit more, but our Board of Health, our county council, actually agreed to provide a substantial amount of funding for our response efforts, which include the case investigation and the contact notification and active monitoring, as well as the support services, including housing for folks in isolation and quarantine. And so we're fortunate here that we're able to do that.
Yeah, roughly one third of the $26.8 million is going to public health. Department of Community Services is also getting a few million. I want to say roughly half between Department of Community Services and us. Roughly half of the CARES Act funding is going there.
So, Jeff,
The other point I want to make is we're contracting some of this out with the Public Health Institute, but the funding that we're getting is actually going to apply, and Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong on this, up to 80 to 90 staff to work on this response.
It's pretty accurate, yeah.
Hello, Jeff.
Yeah.
This is Mark Collier. On the EPH fee increase, I don't think we have seen what the increases are going to be. We knew you were having to redo the fees every year, and we know about the process. I'm just thinking maybe the septic industry would maybe like to see a copy of what's proposed. There was a couple fees in our TAC meeting that we brought up that seemed a little bit, maybe that Chuck was going to look at a little bit closer and everything, and I'm sure he has, but maybe I think as an industry, we'd like to see what's going to be proposed.
Janice, do you want to talk about our process?
Yeah. So, Mark, what we're doing is we want to have the one-on-ones and one-on-twos with the counselors so we have some direction. What we're trying to avoid, I think, is what happened last year where, you know, we were getting a change in direction from the counselors. And so what we were giving our TACs, our technical advisory councils, was not very accurate. And so once we get a clear understanding from the council of what direction they want us to go, then we will be bringing it to the tax at that time. And so hopefully we're going to be earlier than last year. I anticipate we'll be sharing that with you probably early July or early August. I can tell you there was not a significant change to any of the OSS definitions or fee categories. But we can talk, you know, if you want to send me a note, I can talk to Chuck and we can get some input back to you about what happened with those.
Okay, that'd be fine. I don't think we expected any large increases. We just want to be included in the loop and maybe have a chance for comments and reviews before a final adoption.
Yeah, and the final fee schedule is usually adopted in, what is it, Jeff?
Early November, usually we're going to shoot for October this year.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. That was a great update. Before we move on, is there any other question out there for Jeff? Well, you did a great job. No questions. Thank you very much. That was a, there's a lot going on. All you do. Okay, now we're going to go to the presentations and about the COVID-19 update and kind of things that we just talked about earlier. In order to make it easy for people to ask questions, and Janice, I might need a little help from you. We talked about putting the chat screen up so that if people wanted to, they could type in a question, and then it could be addressed, you know, when it's a good time between or within the presentations. But right now, the screen the way it is, I'm not seeing, and maybe it's just
on the bottom. You can click on chat on the bottom. You'll
okay.
See. If you go to the bottom bar on your screen, you'll see there's a chat box there.
I got it. It's just that it. I don't know how to get it over to the side. Let me try this.
No. Just move it with your, put your cursor on it and move it around.
Okay.
You can do that with videos also.
Yeah, that works fine. Thank you. That was very helpful. Okay.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to see the chat with the presentation. So if you do have a question, you can also just interrupt and say your name and we can go that direction also.
You can interrupt me any time.
Well, and maybe...
to my monologue, it'll be over for everybody. And this could be a discussion, really. I'm sure people have questions.
That's what I was just thinking. Is so, Alan and Roxanne, if periodically you pause and just ask folks if they have comments or questions, that will give people the go-ahead, the green light to participate and when it's a good time for you to. All right. Well, let's take it away. I think you're first, Alan, to talk about the COVID-19.
We have the two new positives. Somebody added them. Because earlier there was six. We had two more today. So just the numbers. We're up to 605 cases and 28 deaths. And about a little bit you see the number of people have been tested. It's a little bit of an undercount because not all the negative tests get posted. But that's kind of where we are right now. Next slide. And these are, so the blue line there is the cumulative number of cases over time, and the bars are cases per day. And you can see, so the bars are really what's called an epi curve, and I'm going to point out a couple of things. One is, you can see over to the left there that we peaked in the number of cases in kind of mid-March, and then it tapered off, and you can see the decrease. But now you see these new increases. The first one is the Firestone outbreak, and the next one is probably maybe related to Pacific Crest building supply, which I'll talk about in a minute. But you can also look at that cumulative curve, and you could see that as the curve kind of was steep early in March, and then it kind of flattened out a little bit, and then you can see this steep increase again. That's kind of Firestone. You can ignore this stuff somewhat on the gray area because the data are still coming in on that area, but it kind of gives us a picture of what we've been dealing with over the last few months. The concern I have, and I'll talk about this more as we begin to open up, for example, with these companies, we're likely to see increases in cases. Talk about the Firestone Pacific Foods outbreak. So we're notified of the first case on Saturday, May 16th, and we advised them to stop production, but they also decided on their own to stop production as well. Basically what we did with Firestone, once we heard about the So on Saturday the 16th, we got reported one case, and we didn't know it was associated with Firestone. We began investigating it on Monday, and then later on Monday, two more cases came in that were associated with Firestone. And then we actually worked with Labor and Industries and took a look at some of the conditions, the risk conditions in the production facility, and they agreed to close production on the 19th, which was Tuesday. And I think by then we had about six cases. We decided to do universal testing, testing everybody who worked in the facility. And we also decided to test their close contacts, their household members. And as you can see, we ended up testing about 173 people. I think they have 182 employees. We can't force everybody to get tested, but we ended up finding 132 cases, 79 in employees. And when you think about the total number, that's kind of like 40% of the employees ended up testing positive, very high attack rate. And then of their close contacts, about a third of them, we were able to test 155, and a third of them tested positive. And Vancouver Clinic was really a great partner in this. They're the same folks who are testing in the long-term care facilities. And Firestone agreed the employees are basically uninsured. They provide some health services, but Firestone agreed to pay for the testing of the employees, and we found a large, as you can see, we found a large number of folks who were tested positive. And they, of course, were isolated, and their close contacts were quarantined. Okay, next slide. We actually found out, I thought it was 22. It says 20 there, but there were a significant number of people who were asymptomatic that we would not have found and otherwise, and could have infected other people. And the other point I want to make is, you know, when we isolate and quarantine folks, we have a responsibility to make sure they're taken care of. So I think Jeff already mentioned this, but we ended up supporting them with things like groceries and rental assistance. Okay. And then the other point I'm going to make soon when I talk about the phase two is the Firestone, those cases appeared on the same day we were applying for a phase two variant. So I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Okay, Pacific Crest. More recently, as of June 9th, this is the most recent data, we were notified of the first case on June 4th. So Pacific Crest, the Pacific Crest Building Supply, and by the way, Firestone, I should backtrack a little bit, they're a fruit processing plant. They make frozen fruit. This is a totally different Pacific Crest Building Supply. One of the things they make are cabinets, and they're actually, I haven't verified this, but they are a major, major supplier of cabinets for the entire Portland, Vancouver metropolitan area. So we were notified of the case on Thursday. They stopped production. Some of their employees have Kaiser. Some of them have other insurance or uninsured. So we work with Kaiser and Vancouver Clinic to test everyone. And we started testing on Friday and through the weekend. And actually, Pacific Labor and Industries, again, kind of is helping. And they're taking a look at the, just like they did with Firestone, they're taking a look at their practices to ensure that they're protecting their staff from COVID-19 transmission. So far, we found 19 cases. 44 folks have tested negative, but a significant attack rate. I think the attack rate is going to be lower because Kaiser was, there was a little bit of delay in getting the negative test results. So I think the number is less than 91 that are still awaiting. I think our attack rate here, just off the top of my head, I'm talking to staff late this afternoon, is going to be about 20%, about 1 in 5. The last I heard the numbers before this presentation was put together was something like 21 cases out of 104 folks tested, but we'll be getting more information on that. Still fairly significant, and we're deciding what to do with Pacific Crest. With Firestone, we actually we asked them to remain closed until we were able to clear enough people out of isolation and quarantine that they could basically be able to operate. With Pacific Crest, we're going to be talking with Labor Industries, see what the conditions are, and then make a decision about, you know, folks who can work and who can't work. the cases are certainly isolated, as well as their close contacts are in the quarantine. Okay, next slide. Let's talk about long-term care facility testing. So you know that we've done some of this. When we've had a case in either a staff person or in a resident, we've done facility-wide COVID-19 testing of both staff and residents. And you might remember, was in the paper, that, for example, at Highgate, we were able to find a significant number of people who were infected in their memory care unit, including some who are asymptomatic. The state got a grant. I believe the Bill and Gates Foundation is involved in this, but they're going to be, they issued an order required testing of all residents of staff and staff at nursing homes by June 12th, and then assisted living facilities with memory care units by June 26th. And the state is providing all the testing supplies and protective equipment to the facilities. And the facilities can send specimens to labs at no cost. And you can see where the cost of testing is covered by. So they're going to be doing that for all nursing homes and memory and assisted living facilities with memory care units. And we'll keep back posted in terms of what they're finding. This is both staff and residents, and it's one-time testing. Okay, next slide. So let's talk about our ramp-up in terms of, we're calling it, we don't like to call it contact tracing, we like to call it contact notification and active monitoring. So we'll talk about that here in a minute. Follow us next. No questions in the chat box yet. So we had a couple, yeah, go ahead.
I think Roxanne was going to cover this.
Oh, are you going to cover this part, Roxanne? I'm sorry.
No, I'm happy to.
I thought I was covering it, but that's fine.
Yeah. Does anybody, before we move here, does anybody have any questions about the any of the outbreaks or anything, or any of the data?
Hey, Dr. Melnick, this is Dave Fuller.
Yeah.
I was curious, and actually I meant to ask you this yesterday, if we're seeing the same percentage of asymptomatic patients from the Pacific Crest that we saw over at Firestone Foods.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers on that yet because we're still investigating those cases. I apologize, I don't have it at this moment in terms of how many of them were asymptomatic. Do you want to talk about this? Oh, go ahead, Marla.
I have a question related to that same thing. So given our outbreaks here locally and then others across the state and the nation, is there a way to come up with like a number, a percentage of the total cases that are asymptomatic, or to give us some other information that would be helpful? Because I feel like, I mean, is it something like for every positive COVID test where the person came in because they had symptoms, there's like, you know, 25%, if that's 100%, then 25% would be asymptomatic. Is there a way to break it down like that?
So the answer to that is we don't know. I'm going to I'll try to be as brief about this as I can. The recommendations right now are not that people without symptoms get testing. So the recommendations are, even now that we have testing available, is if you have symptoms, you can talk to your provider and seek testing. And now there's enough testing available. So up till now, most of the people who are positive are symptomatic, virtually all of them. We elected to do mass testing, both in the long-term care facilities that we have, as well as the Firestone, and as well as Pacific Crest. So we elected to test everybody. That's why we're finding asymptomatic cases. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's representative of what was done before, because in most situations, there are only people with symptoms being tested. I think what the state is doing with this one-time testing of long-term care facilities will be really kind of interesting to see if they turn up, even because they'll be testing everybody. So we'll have a better idea of that. But, you know, our situation was also different because they're doing universal testing of staff at long-term care, at nursing homes and assisted living facilities, staff and residents, without any cases at all. So they may find, not only, they may not find anybody, let alone asymptomatic cases. We elected to do mass testing in situations where we had a few cases, and we tested people with and without symptoms. So it's like an apples and oranges. I'm not articulating this very well, but it's an apples and oranges situation. We do know from what's known in studies, you know, globally, that not only can there be, you know, a large number of people who are asymptomatic, but they're also capable of transmitting the disease. You know, we're just gathering more information about this disease. I think younger people are more likely to be asymptomatic than older people as well. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer. You know, the other thing about the Firestone population is we had a low number. Only one person was hospitalized, and we had a large number of asymptomatic people, but that's a younger working population as well. So I think it really depends on what age, you know, what age group you're looking at when you do the testing or what the setting for testing is. Sorry for the long answer.
No, that's helpful. Thanks.
Roxanne, do you want to do this part? I'm sorry. I kind of didn't realize.
No worries. And you're welcome to jump in, too. So Jeff had talked a little bit about Public Health Institute when we were talking about the budget piece of it. And one of the things, so we've been in incident command now since, I don't know, March. And I think that with command, basically, what we're doing is we're using our onboard staff to really manage this response. And when we have these spikes, when we have these outbreaks, it's an enormous amount of work for staff members. And so not only are we pulling all of our nurses, our nurse family partnership nurses, our CD nurses, and we're also bringing in contract or temporary nurses to help us with these case interviews and also the contact notification, it's a tremendous amount of load on our onboard staff. And they've been doing this for quite a while. The other thing is, Dr. Melnick will be talking in a minute about the waiver, which, you know, the application to move into phase two. And one of the metrics was that we would need to have capacity to really meet when there was a surge capacity requirement, when there was an outbreak like Firestone or Pacific Crest. And so one of the ways to meet that metric and then to also allow our folks to get back to their day jobs is we decided to contract with Public Health Institute, which is a nonprofit organization that's really a worldwide. And this is their mission and this is what they do. And they've just been fantastic to work with. They're also working right now with Multnomah County. I believe that they're potentially going to work with Skamania, possibly Cowlitz. So there's other counties in the vicinity and our near vicinity that they'll be working with as well. But basically, what we asked them to do is fill several positions. Well, we're going to continue with the case interviewing, which requires resident registered nurses for that function. We are bringing in temporary nurses through Advantage Staffing to do that internally. But we're also coordinating with Public Health Institute to then do the contact notification, contact interviewing for the people who end up being cases and whoever they feel like their contacts are, Public Health Institute is actually going to be actively monitoring those contacts. So our folks and our TIV nurses that are on site will continue or on site virtually at this point. They're going to continue to do that case investigation where they contact the cases that are actually positive. They'll get a list of the contacts that those positive cases had. These contacts will be handed off to Public Health Institute, who will then do active monitoring of those contacts, which means daily calls. We're going to be making sure that folks that are contacted stay in quarantine or in some cases isolation. And then we will be monitoring them throughout until such a time where they're no longer either infectious or they're out of that quarantine period. And so Public Health Institute, initially we were going to be ramping this up, but they came on board with us a little bit early to help us with the Firestone cases. And they had 20 staff already kind of in the hopper that they were able to pull and immediately deploy for us in that situation. They're also continuing to interview and hire other staff. And by the end of this month, we should have close to 40 staff members through Public Health Institute that will be helping us with this response. We've got nine contract nurses right now that we're working with. We expect to have approximately 18 on board, possibly 20. We're also hiring through Clark County program managers to help manage this whole group that we're having, that we're going to be bringing on. And at such a point where we have the capacity to really manage this, then we will be demobilizing our incident management team. And this whole staff structure will roll under and be managed through our communicable disease team. So we're kind of doing all of that all at the same time, and we're hiring people, and we're trying to place people and get people trained. So it's a lot of work. But Public Health Institute has just been wonderful to work with. They're the utmost professionals. They've been helping us a lot with the Firestone cases. And Firestone has been really anxious to kind of get folks back to work. And so Public Health Institute has been a great partner, not only with us, but also with Firestone as well. Ellen, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
I think you did a great job. I mean, the nice thing about Public Health Institute is we can ramp up and ramp down as necessary, depending on what happens. And it was a lot easier way of doing it than hiring all those folks directly ourselves. And the other thing is, they're multilingual as well, and they're committed to hiring folks locally. So they actually came into the process with a pool of several hundred, I believe 500 folks to interview and put to work, including people in the area. They're also contracting with Washington County in Oregon for the same thing, and they're satisfied there as well. So they do, as Roxanne was saying, they do work. They've done work for the CDC. They do work all over the world and do a lot, you know, including communicable disease control. So it's been a real godsend.
A couple more things that they're going to be doing is for us as well is hiring a couple more epidemiologists and data analysts, data entry folks that will also be assisting. A couple of other things that are we're doing in coordination with Public Health Institute will be those wraparound services that Jeff was talking about, making sure you have people that have groceries and things like that. So we'll be coordinating with Public Health Institute as we find folks that need these wraparound services, whether they're groceries or whether they're mental health services or whatever. Public Health Institute will be coordinating with us to make sure that we have boots on the ground to actually get folks those services that they need, which is fantastic. The other gap in this right now that we're really working on, and I don't know if we're going to be able to manage this or not, is the infectious prevention practitioner. We actually wanted two of those folks who would work with organizations, so for instance, like a Firestone or Pacific Crest or maybe a healthcare provider. When they had an outbreak, the idea would be we would have the practitioner go in and help those organizations with their protocols, their infectious disease prevention protocols, to make sure that we identified where there were gaps in our system and where they could really mitigate that. We were hoping to have two folks that would do that work, but it's a very specialized registered nurse, they have to have a specific certificate to do that work. So we've not been able to identify those two folks yet. We're still looking. And so that's a piece of this whole staffing structure that we wanna make sure that we're able to do. But it just depends upon if there's staffing out there to do that. We will still provide that information, even if we may not be able to go out on site. We will still provide that information to any of the facilities that need it, and we will walk them through it on the phone if we need to, if we do not have actually bodies that can go out. So that function will still happen. It would be much better if we had those positions in place that could actually go out and need the facilities. But
we wanted to have them available for long-term care facilities like nursing homes. Sure. Well,
yeah,
because there's been issues there. Yeah.
So does anybody have any questions on this?
This is Joan, and I just wonder how is public health and the county, this isn't going to go away for a while, you know, if ever. And so how are you positioning yourself in terms of, and maybe this is a question to Jeff and all of you, you know, for the future so that, you know, that we're not always behind the eight ball, that, you know, and we know that prevention, if we could put more into prevention, we might be able to save that money down the road. And so I'm just wondering what kinds of discussions have gone on in terms of planning budget for the future to be as well prepared as possible so that we are doing as much upfront upriver as we can to prevent the downriver cost.
Now, before Jeff gets into the budget, let me just say that the idea of physical distancing was the measure that was used, and it has been successful, and it was used because we were late to the game in testing, and we were late to the game in our ability to respond with case identification, which is part of the testing piece, case interviews and contact notification and active monitoring. We did not have that in place in January, February, or March. That's why that contributed to the mess we're seeing now, and that's why all this physical distancing was used. Down the road, and Jeff will get in. I'll let Jeff, after I'm done yakking here, I'll let Jeff pick up. But the idea now is this whole idea about testing and case identification, contact notification, and active monitoring is preventive. The way, without a vaccine or without a treatment available for this disease, the only way to prevent it, besides physical distancing, is to identify cases quickly, isolate them, identify their contacts, quarantine their close contacts. That's the only way to control this without a vaccine and without adequate treatment. So, I'll let Jeff talk about the budget about this, but this ramp up, I understand the funding is only available, right now until the end of October. But this ramp up, until we get a vaccine or treatment, we're going to have to be able to have a robust process for, case identification, contact identification, and isolation and quarantine. And I'll stop there. And Jeff, you can talk about the monetary aspects of it.
Well, the coronavirus aspect alone, we definitely know that the $250,000 a year we've got beyond October is not going to be sufficient for any large-scale response. Back to sort of the more longer-term preventive budgets programs, we've long struggled to identify, funding to cover non-mandated programs. It's been an issue for many, many years. I've been here since 1998, and at this point, we're down to mandated services plus a few other programs. And again, we're looking at another budget deficit for 2021. We've long said that the public health funding model in this country is not sustainable. It's not what we face is what happens. Your costs increase, your revenue stays flat at best, and you end up chipping away at those important services. It's really sad to see. I've been pushing for many years for the county to go into a priority-based budgeting exercise. I probably talked about it at FAC before, but really it would involve the county council playing a key role in prioritizing services within Clark County and allow some, possibly for some community input, etc. But the practice has always been across the board budget cuts. Every department cut 5%, every department cut 10%. And when you already have a budget system that's not sustainable, that really doesn't help us. I hear what you're saying, Joan. We've struggled with this for many years.
Is there anything at this point in time, and again, I don't want to say let's capitalize on this tragedy, but is there something that we could do as FAC to bring this issue to light, that the funding model for public health is not sustainable? I know we're working on the foundational public health through the legislature, but here in our county, is there anything that we could do as FAC to help our county council? And the good news is there's some understanding because they gave public health some of the money that came. But, I mean, is there anything that we can do to really, as FAC, to help educate our council and our community about the need for sustainable public health funding?
Yeah, I think based on conversations we have with the county manager, we'll be able to engage FAC down the road possibly this year. I would say FAC played a very key role in securing the 1% property tax increase, I believe it was in 2011, dedicated completely to us. The county is in a very difficult situation with their budget. There's not additional revenue. They're looking at at budget cuts. They're looking at a shortfall. It's going to be a very difficult time to get any additional support for 2021. But longer term, I continue to push for, again, things like priority-based budgeting, those exercises. Every chance I get, every chance I'm asked for an opinion, or even not even asked for my opinion, I share it. So
the other issue is we've gotten leaner over the years, and we've lost funding. We lose our surge capacity to be able to
And I just want to make sure that public health knows that FAC is there if there's a position that we can take, like we've done on issues in the past, like you mentioned, Jeff, that I think that that's our role, and I think that we could be very helpful, because I think we're all in our own different practice world that are now seeing the impact of this on businesses, neighbors, friends, you know, the whole gamut, and a lot of it is, the job that public health is doing is absolutely exemplar, but it's not sustainable unless there's, we get funding. So I think that, it's something that I'm just going to stay attentive to this as long as I'm on this council. So, but thank you so much for your responses.
We launch into the phase two, or okay. So I'm just going to go back a little, put a little history on this. So, May 19th was when the governor announced the criteria to allow larger counties to apply for phase two variants, and at that time, it required fewer than 10 cases per 100,000 people over the last 14 days. And actually, we submitted our variance request application to the Secretary of Health on Friday, May 22nd. That was the day we got our part of the application required the board to approve it, and the board of health and the county council had to vote for it. We had to get a letter from the hospitals stating that they had adequate PPE and adequate capacity. So we submitted it, but Friday, May 22nd was the same day we began with the Vancouver Clinic doing that active, with testing everybody at Firestone. And that day Vancouver Clinic did 50 tests and 26 of them came out positive. We had 26 new cases that day. But it's way over the 10 per 100,000. And basically, we're told by the secretary on Saturday the 23rd that our request was put on hold. And then he asked for additional information on to provide on the following Thursday, and we requested a timeline for moving to phase two. So the next slide. So on Monday, June 1st, We had a meeting with secretary, and actually, at that point, the state had changed their criteria, so it moved from 10 per 100,000 to 25 per 100,000, but even at that, we were, with Firestone, we were above that. You can see that about the hospitalizations for COVID-19 that were flat or decreasing, the hospital bed capacity. We were fine on those things. Our testing capacity and positivity rate was 50 times the number of cases. We had met that until the Firestone situation because a large number of those tests were positive. One of the metrics and the reason why we're ramping up with a Public Health Institute is how quickly we follow up with cases and contacts, how staff we are for case interviews and contact notification, and the number of outbreaks. So we went over that with Secretary Wiesman on Monday evening, June 1st, and then on the following day, June 2nd, we put the application together. You can go to the next slide. And we submitted that by the end of business day on June 2nd. You'll notice that the first case around Pacific Crest was like deja vu. We were notified on June 4th. Fortunately, the Secretary of Health approved the application to move to phase two on Friday, June 5th. We had a long conversation with with Secretary Wiesman about this, including the fact that the longer we delayed in doing this, and we basically, if you took Firestone out of the picture, and we had that fairly well, I think we did a good job on containing that and keeping it from spilling out into the community. If you took that out of the picture, we met the metrics pretty well. And as I mentioned earlier, as things open up, from time to time, we're going to see these outbreaks in businesses. Spokane was approved for a phase two variance, I think the same time we submitted our original application. And they didn't have an outbreak that same day, but several days later, they had an outbreak in a macaroni plant. So they end up having more cases than we do, but they were in phase two. So we made that point to the secretary, and we were approved on Friday, and we are going to make, based on what the governor's requirement is, that you remain in a specific phase for at least 3 weeks. And that's because it can, you know, the incubation period for COVID-19 can be up to 14 days. So once you relax things and relax physical distancing, you need not only a couple of weeks for more cases to possibly develop, but another week to basically gather the data, analyze the data, get it reported. And 3 weeks seems like amount of time to, according to the governor, to be able to determine whether things are still flat or decreasing or whether you need to stay in a particular phase longer. Next slide. Okay, so the phase reopening, there's four phases. We're now in phase two. I'm not going to, you can go on the governor's site and see the fine print on all these. But I think the next slide, I think, discusses some of the highlights in phase two, where we're at. So there's guidances for the business by industry. You can get that. I think we have links to it on our website, as well as the DOH website and the governor's website. It's not like, this is another point I made to Secretary Wiesman, is that in granting us phase two, it's not like we breached the dams and suddenly opened everything up. You can't have gatherings more than five people outside a household per week. Same thing for outdoor recreation. Religious services are limited to 25% capacity or 50 people. They're still strongly encouraged high-risk populations, for example, those over the age of 65 to stay home unless they're participating in permissible phase one or phase two activities. Next slide. I think there's more phase two stuff here. The restaurants have to be less than 50% capacity. Table size no more than five. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you can see what's open now. So there are a number of things that are available now, and there's some guidances around all of. Okay, next slide. Phase three will be at least, I believe, 21 days after phase two. Still somewhat restrictive. The gatherings could be larger. Now you've got gyms and public pools open, but less than 50% capacity. Restaurants now go from 50% to 75% capacity. Five, now 10 per table rather than five. Bar areas can open. Theaters can open at 50% capacity, and so on. All of the business activities, I believe nightclubs and events of more than 50 people are not open. So, and again, you're still encouraging high-risk populations to stay home. And then, next slide, phase four is basically large gatherings. Basically, all recreational activities are open, including concerts, sporting events, and everything else. So, the earliest, I mean, in thinking about it, it'd be, we have to get to phase three, and then phase four could be, the minimum is going to be 6 weeks. And given, you know, it's really going to depend on the data and the metrics and what's happening now that we're opening things up. But I think that might be it. I mean, there's a lot of concerns that even with phase two and even in phase one, people are not necessarily respecting the physical distancing requirements that exist and are not masking when they should be masking. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over time. I am concerned that the numbers may very well go up. And that's it for me. And there's a chat question.
Okay.
So the chat question is, yes. Katie, how do you think the protesting for the BLM movement will influence COVID-19 stats?
Yeah, I assume BLM is Black Lives Matter. So actually, we're on, I don't want to single that out because I think there's a lot of areas where people are close together. I know that people are going to be gathering data on that. I know that Seattle, I was on a call today with Seattle King County, and they're actually asking people, and we may want to talk to, one of the things you do when you do the case investigations, when you have a case, is you ask them where they've been. Now that we have more case investigators, given the incubation period, we're going to want to ask people where they were during the time when they could have picked up the infection. I don't think we've been doing that up till now because of our staffing, and it takes more time in an interview. King County and their case investigation interviews are actually asking people, they're going to ask people about where they've been for the last 14 days before they became sick. And I heard on the call today that they're going to be specifically asking people, among other things, whether they participated in any of the protest activities. So we may want to consider asking, I think we're going to probably want to consider asking questions like that. But I wouldn't limit it to the protesting. People are doing all kinds of things. But people are gathering data on that. It certainly is a potential risk. Fortunately, from what I've seen of the protests, most of the people are wearing masks, which will be helpful. But and I can understand why people want to protest, because the issue that they're protesting, especially, has huge impacts on the health of our communities. So hopefully we'll gather some data on that, though.
So Aru had another question, which is it mandatory for employees to wear masks in phase two, example, like at hair salons?
Yeah, it depends on the guidance, and I have to take a look at the guidance for the hair salons, but I think it is, they're supposed to have those kinds of things in place. So it really depends on the situation. But I think most of the business guidance is that you do use masks. Again, masks are not a substitute for physical distancing as well. It relates to the specific. Yeah, I'd look at the specific guidance for businesses. And they're based on particular businesses, so there is a specific guidance for hair salons.
Dr. Melnick, this is Dave. Actually, there's a lot of guidance out there from the Washington Labor and Industries, and a lot of that's been posted at the governor's website as well as the county website. And you're right, it kind of depends on what the business is, but for the most part, the default is if a business for their employees can't provide a greater than 6 feet distance, then they have to wear a mask.
Yeah, and hairdressers are, there's no 6 feet distance there.
Dr. Melnick, I just wanted to also point out that for these, we're talking a lot about really small businesses like a beauty salon and things like this. And those folks, I've looked at their requirements for sanitizing the area between clients. They can't have any waiting room. They can't have a lot of things in their shop that they normally might have. And it sounds like, the burden on them is pretty heavy. And then in order to maintain the time to clean in between and all that, and the physical distancing necessary, their amount of capacity is very decreased. So it'll be interesting to see. And also people aren't really, turning out for things like they used to. Everybody's kind of waiting to see. So it'll be just interesting to see, and hopefully these small businesses they have no economies of scale sometime, that they can get past this, and they're a really important part of our economy. So
some of them are choosing not to open because it just, they can't do it economically given the restrictions. I mean, those restaurant restrictions are pretty significant.
Yeah. There's another question, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sharp had a question. As cases continue to increase, is it feasible that we will actually go into phase three in that time frame?
That is a great question. Given given what's happened recently, I have some real concerns about that. But, a lot of it is really going to depend on our ability, now that we're relaxing the physical distancing, is going to be our ability to do case, identify cases quickly, do the investigation, identify the close contacts, and quarantine them. I mean, that's how we were able to control measles. And you might recall that after March 1st, 87% of the measles transmissions were in non-public settings. They were basically in situations where you had siblings who are quarantined infecting each other. And it really depends on how, we're trying to scale this up as quickly as possible, but it really depends on how able we're able, as we relax physical distancing, how we're able to control this by using isolation and quarantine. And so I don't have an answer for that, but we're going to do our best. And, it's not just us, it's everybody around us. So, in this case, Clark County is connected to everybody else, including our neighbors to the south of the river. So, I wish I had a better answer for that question, but we'll do our best.
Dr. Melnick, could you speak to the possibility of, the drive-through testing centers that we've seen in other areas? Because we see so many asymptomatic cases that you've mentioned, I'm wondering if we're going to try and open up our testing abilities.
That's a really great question. There's actually a lot of testing capacity in Clark County right now. We have all the places on our website. And the best metric of whether you're actually identifying cases is if your positivity is 2% or lower, and we're actually there. The other point I want to make about that is, believe it or not, there's not a huge demand for testing. You might remember a couple of months ago, people were complaining that they wanted to get tested and they can't find somebody to test them. Now it's just the opposite. People are not really asking for testing. So I don't know. If we opened it up and had more drive-through testing, number one, I don't think a lot of people would show up. And number two is I don't think we'd find a whole lot. I think the recommendations are still to get tested if you're, if you have symptoms and, you're concerned about it. But there's a lot of testing available, and we are testing more than, around 50 times the number of cases we're finding.
Interesting.
So, Dr. Melnick, I said this before, but you and your team are really to be congratulated for this process. And while there's 7 bullet points that you listed there to go to phase 2, the work behind that I know is just huge. And the pressure that was being put on you was phenomenal. And again, I just want to thank you and congratulate you for being able to navigate through that process, even though hurdles were being thrown at you left and right and so on.
But Dave, you're really kind, but you're part of the process. I mean, you've been working around the clock. I'm just thinking of all we went through trying to get adequate PPE. We're still doing some of that, and all the work you and your folks did around getting testing supplies and all the angst we went through that. And then the other point I'd make, we've got some of our team members here, but the Clark County Public Health staff, it's the best health department I've ever worked in. So we have people who are, there are some of our staff that are working literally weeks at a time without a day off. So they've been pretty incredible. But, Dave, you're part of the response. And I appreciate everything Cressa has done as well.
Well, thank you. It's been great to get to work together, but I just definitely want this committee to know that there's a lot of work that's been done by you and your staff to get us to this point. And we're not there yet, but so far it's been great.
The other challenge around COVID-19, every disease, regardless of its biology, has, some sort of political connotations, but I think this one has been going on so long, and there's all these economic impact as well as the politics around this have been really, and then, you know, kind of like measles, the other barrier has been all the misinformation that's going on around us. You know, you can take a look at our Facebook page and you can see, you know, it can give you deja vu for what happened with measles, a lot of the misinformation that's going on there. But the economic impact of this and the political impact of this has been really pretty considerable. So I think that's been a strain for everybody as well. But yeah, we have a great community. I mean, our council has been real supportive. Our Board of Health has been real supportive throughout this whole thing.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. I was just going to say that Clark County in general, I mean, the public health department is by far and away, and CRESA as well, and our first responders, and has been huge in allowing us to get through this as elegantly as we are, and I think it's pretty impressive, really. I mean, it's a very hard time.
Before I forget, I want to say our healthcare partners have been incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Mutel, the Vancouver Clinic, Legacy, they've been there, and I couldn't think of better healthcare partners. And I'm sorry, Marla, I cut you off on that.
Oh, that's okay.
I didn't forget to mention the great.
While we're thinking about the, I guess one thing that kind of keeps me feeling uplifted when these are kind of difficult times is thinking about all the people who are really making a difference every day. And so in addition to the healthcare providers and all of those associated with supporting those systems, it's just, we had a water problem. The county came out, they were proper social distancing and doing everything right to protect themselves and others, and took care of the problem. These services are still being provided, and the number of companies that are now providing curbside pickup and delivery and so many different things that can make it possible for those who are trying to stay at home to be able to do so. So I just think it would be kind of neat when things begin to subside and we have catch our breath, is to just kind of reflect upon all of those pieces of the network that are making it as manageable as it can possibly be. And there's just an awful lot of gratitude to go that I feel for everybody that's been part of this.
So Aru has a question, by the way, before. Oh, go. Janice, is that what you're going to say? You're going to point out Aru's question. So Aru basically asked, what is the positivity rate in our county for COVID-19? So that's a really good question, because the positivity rate is something we look at in terms of disease activity in the community. So so to give you an example, at the height of the pandemic in the Puget Sound areas, they were running positivity rates of about 13-15%. Back in March, our positivity rate was around, I believe, 8-9%. And if I showed you a curve of positivity rates, it actually dropped. And for the last several weeks, our positivity rate was below 2%, which is one of the metrics we use. And this is off the top of my head because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe we went up over 3%. We may have even been a little bit higher once we had the, because you add the Firestone situation where you got 40% of those, you know, those folks positive, it skewed the data a little bit. But up until then, our positivity rate for the last 4 weeks had been below 2%. So I hope that answers the question, but that's really a way of looking at how one of the metrics we use besides, you know, hospitalizations for COVID-19 like illness, emergency room visits. By the way, since I'm on my soapbox here, our team did a really cool, we've been doing syndromic surveillance, so we've been looking at other indicators, and like hospitalizations, like ER visits for COVID-19, like illness. One of the things they looked at recently, and I just saw the graphic, was they had done syndromic surveillance visits to healthcare facilities or mental health situations that occur during disasters, like panic, stress, and anxiety. If those are listed in the ICD-10 diagnoses when they're visiting healthcare facilities. And sure enough, there was a blip in March around the same time we were seeing these other things around mental health conditions that are associated with disasters. And we actually, I sent that off to the Director of Community Services because I thought it was really interesting, but it highlights the, you know, the impact of COVID-19 in the community that includes, you know, things like panic disorder, stress, and anxiety were increased, you know, visits to healthcare facilities. So we use a number of metrics to look at what's going on. Sorry, I can get off yakking about this for a long time.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan. This is our just to highlight what you said about the mental health piece. So when the COVID first broke out, we saw mental health visits at Vancouver Clinic drop about 50 or 60%. I mean, everyone was scared to leave their house, and now we're actually seeing more people than we did pre-COVID. Lots of depression, anxiety. So yeah, I definitely see that in my own practice, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're going to continue to track that one. I didn't come up with this. Our epidemiologist came up with that. That was brilliant to look at it.
Marla has a question. Is the positivity rate reflected in the positive cases per 100,000 lives? And is there a better way to find it?
Yeah, so it's not the rate. So the cases per 100,000. So when you test positive, you're a case. So we count up the number of cases over 14 days. And if it's 25 per 100,000, our population is about, you know, just under 500,000. So if we have under 125 cases over 14 days, then we're, you know, we meet that metric. But the positivity rate is the number of all the tests you do, the number, the percentage that are positive. The rate per 100,000 is the rate of cases in the population. So let me say it a little bit easier. The positivity rate, the denominator is the total number of people who get tested, and the numerator is the number who test positive. For the population rate, you know, that 25 per 100,000, the denominator is the county, is the total population of the county, and the numerator is the number of cases in the county over that time period. I hope that explained that.
Yeah, that does help, because I was trying to figure out a way to make it easier to extrapolate to, you know, what you're talking about with the positivity. So that's helpful. And I also like that you've broken it down into the zip codes. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, we got some little pushback on that early on. We originally had the number of cases per zip code. I wouldn't say pushback. There was a little bit. So we decided to display that, and we needed to put some caveats on it because the way cases are reported is based on where they live, not where they acquired the infection. So you could go on be on a cruise ship and come home to Battleground, for example, and your case gets counted in Battleground. But people were looking at these maps, and they were thinking, oh, that, you know, this zip code has to be a hot spot. The other difficulty we faced early on was that the zip codes don't have equal population. So if you just kind of map based on the number of cases, it might make some zip codes look worse than others. So we change it to a rate. And those are some of the things that we went through. You know, we're trying to get information out there. Whenever you get information out there, you have to be really careful about how it gets interpreted.
Mm-hmm. Dave had a question. How do they calculate the R-naught number?
Yeah, so the R-naught number, you need a large number to do that. But the R-naught is basically, for each case, the number of secondary cases that occur. So for measles, you know, if you look at the data for measles going back to, you know, as long as we had this data on measles, one person with measles, if they're surrounded by susceptible folks, about 12 to 18 of those folks will get infected. So with measles has an R naught somewhere between 12 and 18. with COVID-19, the R naught, you know, if you have everybody susceptible around a person with COVID-19, you'll get around, I think, around 2 to 4 people who are who get infected. You can modify that by using isolation and quarantine. By doing so, you know, by isolating folks, you reduce the number of susceptibles around them that they can pass the infection to. So, and physical distancing helps with that too, because if you physically distance people, if somebody's a case but they're physically distant from other people, they're going to infect less people. That's how physical distancing works. So it's basically looking at the data of cases, and then, you know, the number of cases that each case basically links to. I'm not explaining it really well, but as long as the R naught is above 1, so an R naught of 1 means that each case, and when you look back and do these case investigations and contact tracing, an R naught of 1 means that each case gave the infection transmitted to one other person. Anything above that will almost increase exponentially, because each person gives it to more than one other person. You want to get the R naught under 1, and then the number of cases will decrease. I'm not sure I explained that very well, but it's basically looking at the data and looking at how many each case, how many subsequent cases arose from each case.
I had a question for Sharp. I was wondering how's it going with the schools, and how is planning going for potentially reopening?
Well, I have not had to say I don't know more times than I have in the last 3 months. So we wait on the state, and then we wait on, at the building level, we wait on, you know, guidance from our district office, and there's a group of us that are part of that thing, committee, basically trying to determine what it might look like in the fall. There was supposed to have been, OSPI was going to release their guidelines yesterday, but they actually pushed it out to the end of the week. And ultimately, we just don't know. If we come back, it's going to have to be in some limited capacity. I was kind of hoping to get some information from here, actually, tonight. Because ultimately, you know, when I talked to my bosses, they sort of shrugged their shoulders, and we try to come up with a plan. We're going to try to have a rotating schedule to have fewer people in the building. The mask issue has become a very big political issue. In our community is a more rural conservative community, where it's this strange sort of, and I saw this happening, you know, before the shutdown even, where it was becoming politicized, and you know, and then there are some schools of thinking that if we all are required to wear masks to come back, why would we even come back? In a physical sense. I mean, we're going to have the way we were directed by the state was that no students could fail. And so a lot of students have checked out if they had passing grades prior to March 13th. That's going to have to look different, because we have to keep students progressing. You know, and right now it's just do no harm is the main mantra. But ultimately, we really don't know. You know, I've been very impressed. You know, I can only really speak for my staff, but I have friends, lots of friends who are administrators and teachers, and to have to try to reinvent what we've been doing for a couple hundred years in a couple of weeks was pretty. I've been impressed with the flexibility. You know, especially when you have staffs that are more seasoned, and things like Zoom meetings and Google Documents and all the other technology that's available is frightening, because I'm at this weird age where I can still keep up, but I feel like I'm getting past. And so, and if I think about people I'm working with who are 20 years older than I am, and they, you know, I've been really proud of them, because they've been vulnerable and they had no choice, but they dove in and they have really just tried to adapt. But I've sort of taken on the, I'm just going to try to go week by week and not get too worked up when things don't go the way we thought we had it planned. But I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of political pressure, especially at the lower grade levels, to reopen schools, because parents need to work and childcare is, I mean, it's just ridiculously expensive. I don't know. Yeah. As I say, we've been talking in circles for the last couple of months, really.
Speaking, Charbonneau, of what you're talking about this is Joan, speaking of the child care issue, I hope some of you read the editorial. It was in the paper this morning. And then there was an editorial about 2 weeks ago by Mary Sisson about the child care crisis that we have in this country. And so we've been talking about this at SELF and also on the ACEs Action Alliance about the establishment of a children's commission here in Clark County. And so Cindy and I and Debbie Hamm are working and would like to, and I'll be talking to Roxanne about getting in touch with the executive committee to bring a report to the fact about the child care crisis, which is going to impact people's ability to go back to work because of the number of child care centers that not only is it expensive, but the capacity has decreased significantly because of the inability of child care organizations to stay open. So it's something that Cindy and Debbie and I were talking about today, and we think that the FAC would be a good place to bring the discussion to model something very similar to what we saw with the Commission on Aging when Commissioner Bolt established the Commission on Aging, and then we ended up with the Commission on Aging, which has been addressing the growing baby boomer issue in the community with lots of different recommendations, et cetera. And so we're thinking of the same kind of thing, a joint city council children's commission to address the child care crisis in the community. So, I'll be talking to Roxanne and bringing that to the FAC, hopefully at our next meeting. So thanks.
I want to respect the fact that we have said that our meeting would end at 7, I think is what we had established. Am I right? Yeah. And we're a little bit past that now, and I know we've had to lose at least one person, so I want to make sure that before we start losing people or we need to close the meeting, are there any other comments that FAC members wish to make while we're all together, since this is a great opportunity to share and exchange information? And after that, then we'll close the meeting, unless people wish to continue on beyond the time that we had set. Any comments or questions?
Thanks, Marla, for leading us through the meeting. It's your first full meeting, so glad you're here.
Thank you, Joan.
Dealing with us all online.
I'm grateful to be able to participate. All right, then. Well, then, in that case, in terms of the executive committee, the work that we do is behind the scenes with the public health team, is to think about what kinds of things we want to bring to this group and prepare for the coming meetings, take input from members, and try to just keep moving things forward. So our next meeting is scheduled for August 11th, the format to be determined. And so if there are no other comments or questions, then I'll ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Do we have a second? Do we need that?
I second that, Mark Collier.
Thank you. All right, then the meeting is officially adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone. Bye.
Good meeting. Bye.
Thanks for the meeting.
Bye.